Diana DeHovenessian, how did you know Lowell?
Could I talk about Lowell as a teacher?
Please. Please.
Well, I admired him, as everyone did at that time, as the great pivotal poet of his time. He was the beginning of the modern, as he didn't like it called Confessions, but the beginning of that school, and the end of a long line of English poets that you could always expect a wonderful poem from. He was an American poet, of course, but he was in the tradition of Pound from Milton on. Well, Wordsworth, all of that tradition of poets who wrote in form. He broke with them, but he wrote beautiful, beautiful sonnets. May I talk about him in class?
Please.
I was finished with school, but I heard about the workshop at Harvard and that one could apply to be in it if he approved your work. And I submitted some poems, and I was called to see him, and he said that I could be in it. And I said, all I wanted to do was audit. He said, no, I want you to talk, too. I don't think I did very much talking. I was painfully shy. I sat in the back. It was a bit long table that met weekly, and I'd been told that he probably wouldn't show very often, but he came every single week. That year. It was here in the yard. And then there were office hours afterwards that I never went to. I was too frightened. He was wonderful. He never repeated himself. He would come in each time reciting a poem, a sonnet usually, that he knew by heart. And the first hour was discussing well-known poets. And the second hour was a workshop of students' poetry. He would read a poem and then everyone would comment, and then he would. I had never been in a workshop before.
Hmm. Helen Bender has written of his classes as being peculiarly unstructured. He would sort of mumble. There was no lecture. She said he spoke of all the English poets, in effect, as friends, and the most important thing he did was to introduce them as real minds and real lives at work behind the poetry.
I agree, but I don't think he mumbled. And it seemed definitely structured. It always began, you know, with poems that he thought we should know. And he would talk and he would ask, not questions, but if anyone wanted to make comments. All I remember was that I looked forward to it every week. You know, it was a bright spot. It was the last class. He, as I said, he appeared every week. And he didn't mumble. He read these poems. He didn't read them. He recited them beautifully. You know, I was just admiring, you know, his memory.
Who did you suppose you were looking at in this figure, in a kind of succession of American poets, including, I suppose, his ancestor James Russell Lowell, but also Whitman and Hart Crane and William Carlos Williams and Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot and all the rest? I mean, what part in this grand succession was Robert Lowell supposed to be playing?
Definitely a part of it in this chain. But the end of the other chain and the beginning of new.
Hmm. Was he the beginning of your chain, so to speak?
I'm not part of that. But what he did for me as a translator, for instance, he gave us permission to make the best possible poem and not look at a translation word for word. He was very, very free in his imitations. I don't do translations that freely, but it was a permission. You know, and he gave, I think, his class and students permission to be political. He wasn't as political as, say, Denis Levertov, but he was political. You know, he was a political poet, and he gave us permission to be experimental and free, and gave us permission to use forms, if that's what we wanted.
Mm. Interesting. It sounds as if he validated all your ambitions.
Yeah. I'm so glad that this book is published, and I think it will bring a brand new audience. You know, he had all but disappeared from the poetry scene, which is a pity.
This book makes you think he's back to stay.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Diana, I wish you'd read so many poems here, but read some of your favorites.
Well, there are so many. There's Florence, because I love the city.
I'd love you to read Florence, but give it your own introduction.
It's just because I love the city. I was there with my sister, who introduced me to all these paintings, and never mind, let me just read them.
Florence, for Mary McCarthy. I long for the black ink cuttlefish, April, communists, and brothels of Florence. Everything. Even the British furies who haunted the hills, even the chills and fevers that came once a month and forced me to think. The apple was more human there than here, but it took a long time for the blinding golden rind to mellow. How vulnerable the horseshoe crabs dredging the bottom like flat irons in their antique armor, with their sword-grass black-boned tails made for a child to grab and throw strangling ashore. Oh, Florence, Florence, patroness of the lovely tyrannicides, where the tower of the old palace pierces the sky like a hypodermic needle. Perseus, David, and Judith, lords and ladies of the blood, Greek demigods of the cross, rise sword in hand above the unshaven, formless decapitation of the monsters, tubs of guts, mortifying chunks for the pack. Pity the monsters, pity the monsters. Perhaps one always took the wrong side. Ah, to have known, to have loved too many Davids and Judiths. My heart bleeds black blood for the monster. I have seen the Gorgon, the erotic terror of her helpless big bosom body, lay like slop, wall-eyed, staring, the despot to stone, her severed head swung like a lantern in the victor's hand.
He's talking about the head of Medusa in the hand of Perseus in that famous statue on the terrace there in the piazza. Is he rooting for the monsters?
It sounds like it.
What does that mean? My heart bleeds black blood for the monster.
It sounds like he's rooting for her. Yeah. The outside of Florence, there's a little church of San Miniato. I love Florence because of that little church. San Miniato was an Armenian saint. And he too was beheaded. And he walked, he put his head back on and walked several, he was martyred, and walked several paces to the place where they built the church to him.
So you root for the martyrs too?
Yes, always.
That's interesting. Is that part of the connection here?
For me.
Diana de Hovenessian, read us another Lowell poem.
Middle Age. Now the midwinter grind is on me. New York drilled through my nerves as I walked the chewed up streets. At 45, what next, what next? At every corner, I meet my father, my age, still alive. Father, forgive me my injuries as I forgive those I have injured. You never climbed Mount Zion, yet left dinosaur death steps on the crust where I must walk.
He says, I have forgiven those that I have injured. What's that about? Forgiving the people you've injured.
I guess that's what you do with poetry. You use them and forgive them.
I wish you'd read that poem for Theodore Rethke and introduce it. Who was Rethke and what was their connection about?
Theodore Rethke, who was born in 1908 and died in 1963, much too soon, was a great American poet, one of my favorites, and one of Lowell's favorites. They were friends, and I think they sent poems back and forth to each other. In fact, I know they did. This is Lowell's poem to him. All night you wallowed through my sleep. Then in the morning you were lost in the main sky, close, cold, and gray, smoke and smoke-colored cloud. Sheep-like, unsociable, reptilian, two hell divers splattered, squawking on the water, loons devolving to a monochrome. You, honored nature, helpless elemental creature, the black stump of your hand just touched the waters under the earth and left them quickened with your name. Now you honor the mother, omnipresent, she made you non-existent, the ocean's anchor, our high tide. Yes, so this is a memorial poem to him, how he was once a part of their life, and now he's a part of something bigger, the part of the non-existent, but still the ocean's anchor and our high tide, the high spot, probably, of his memory. Robert Frost at Midnight. This is in a group of poems, all to other poets, with the Rethke one, Sylvia Plath, Randall Jarrell, Louis MacNeice, Wyndham Lewis, William Carlos Williams.
The gang.
Yes.
Harpo Marx.
Harpo Marx. Robert Frost. Robert Frost at Midnight, the audience gone to vapor, the great act laid on the shelf in mothballs. His voice is musical and raw. He writes on the flyleaf, for Robert, from Robert, his friend in the art. Sometimes I feel too full of myself, I say, and he, misunderstanding, when I am low, I stray away. My son wasn't your kind. The night we told him Merrill Moore would come to treat him, he said I'll kill him first. One of my daughters thought things, thought every male she met was out to make her. The way she dressed, she couldn't make a whorehouse. And I, sometimes I'm so happy I can't stand myself. And he, when I am too full of joy, I think how little good my health did anyone near me. That sort of sums up all of Frost's life, in a way, his failures with his family. I want to read a Memories on West Street in Lepke, possibly because I think I heard him reading this poem. And it refers to his teaching on Tuesdays. I don't remember the day that our class at the Harvard workshop was, but I know the Tuesday one, I think, that he refers to is the famous one at Boston University. It's in the famous workshop where he had that big group of poets who later became well-known. Anne Sexton and George Starbuck, for instance. That was slightly before my time. Mm-hmm. This particular poem, Memories of West Street in Lepke, refers to his imprisonment at the West Street prison in New York, where he was in jail for being a conscientious objector during World War II. And at the same time, this Mr. Murderer, Mr. Lepke, was also a prisoner there.
The infamous Louis Lepke of New York.
Yes, exactly. Memories of West Street and Lepke. Only teaching on Tuesdays, bookworming in pajamas, fresh from the washer each morning, I hog a whole house on Boston's hardly passionate Marlborough Street, where even the man scavenging filth in the back alley trash cans has two children, a beach wagon, a helpmate, and is a young Republican. I have a 9-month daughter, young enough to be my granddaughter. Like the sun, she rises in her flame flamingo infant's wear. These are the tranquilized 50s, and I am 40. Ought I to regret my seed time? I was a fire-breathing Catholic CO and made my manic statement, telling off the state and president, and then sat waiting sentence in the bullpen beside a Negro boy with curlicues of marijuana in his hair. Given a year, I walked on the roof of the West Street jail, a short enclosure, like my school soccer court and saw the Hudson River once a day through sooty clothesline entanglements and bleaching khaki tenements, strolling iambic metaphysics with Abramovitz, a jaundiced yellow, it's really tan, and flyweight pacifist, so vegetarian he wore rope shoes and preferred fallen fruit. He tried to convert Bioff and Brown, the Hollywood pimps, to his diet. Hairy, muscular, suburban, wearing chocolate double-breasted suits, they blew their tops and beat him black and blue. I was so out of things I'd never heard of the Jehovah's Witnesses. Are you a CO? I asked a fellow jailbird. No, he answered. I'm a JW. He taught me the hospital tuck and pointed out the T-shirted back of Murder Incorporated Czar Lepke, there piling towels on a rack or dawdling off to his little segregated cell full of things forbidden the common man, a portable radio, a dresser, two toy American flags tied together with a ribbon of Easter palm. Flabby, bald, lobotomized, he drifted in a sheepish calm where no agonizing reappraisal jarred his concentration on the electric chair, hanging like an oasis in his air of lost connections.
It's an amazing cast of characters and images and memories, my God.
Yes, it's called Memories of West Street in Lepke. My memories are of him reading it. I don't remember when.
Just because I remember him very well hanging around Eugene McCarthy in that anti-war campaign of 1968, and of course he'd been to the Pentagon with Norman Mailer, I wish you'd read one of those anti-Vietnam poems that brought Robert Lowell to a kind of high flame and fame in the late 60s. Do you remember that period?
Oh, of course.
Where were you in 72?
Here, marching. For Eugene McCarthy. I love you so. Gone? Who will swear you wouldn't have done good to the country, that fulfillment wouldn't have done good to you, the father, as Freud says. You, with so little faith that anyone ever makes anything better, the same and less, ambition only makes the ambitious great. The state lifts us. We cannot raise the state. All was yours, though, lining down the balls for hours, freedom of the hollow bowling alley, the thundered strikes, the boys. Picking a quarrel with you is like picking the petals of the daisy. The game, the passing crowds, the rapid young still brand your hand with sunflex, coldly willing to smash the ball past those who bought the park.
There's a poet's heart on his sleeve.
Yes, I'll say.
I love it that he begins, I love you so. It is a kind of terrific surrender and testament. What does it mean for a poet's reputation that suddenly there is this one grand doorstop volume that we can all have forever?
It brings him back for a new generation, I believe. And that's a good thing for the generation, people who will discover him anew.
Diana de Hovenesian, thank you very, very much for remembering Lowell and reading.
Thank you, Christopher Lydon, for inviting me.